Hello there, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Psyched to Be With You. Episode 5 in Season 2. An unbelievable guest for you today. Dr. Jamie Madigan, the host of the Psychology of Games podcast that has had everyone and anyone who is worth having on a podcast in the field and more. Absolutely incredible. We had a great chat just generally about psychology, about the psychology of games, about video games, about podcasting. It was just a great chat with a guest that I couldn't believe I was getting to chat to. I only wish I could have continued speaking to him even longer, to be honest. It was a great one. I really hope you enjoy it. All the links and stuff for all the books mentioned in that will be attached to wherever you find this episode. Please enjoy it. Hello there, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Psyched to Be With You with me, your host, Christopher Leach, aka Chim195. Wow, we've done it again. I don't know how, but for some reason, we've got another fantastic guest with you today. Now, as always, I let my guests introduce themselves. However, I will preface this with people and persons listening. If you have even Googled the phrase psychology of games, you have doubtless read and or heard the voice of this special guest. I'm incredibly excited. My very special guest, if you could please introduce who you are and tell us what you do.
Yeah, Chris, I'm eager to learn your secret for booking these kinds of guests myself. But yeah, hey, I'm happy to be here. My name is Jamie Madigan, and I write about the overlap between psychology and video games and podcast and occasionally lecture about it, mostly over at psychologyofgames.com. But I've also put out a couple of books on the topic in the last few years, and I have a podcast as well. So I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, I am incredibly thrilled to have you on the show, Jamie. This, I'm going to say transparency's sake, you know, this all came about through basically Dr. Coa and I. We were chatting on the podcast, and we unanimously agreed, the two of us, that Psychology of Games podcast is kind of the nexus for the field. I was listening to the show ahead of starting my PhD in the psychology of video games, and the plethora of guests that you have had on that show. I went through my mental Rolodex and I actually double checked episode like 2 or 3. You have my own director of studies, Dr. Linda Kay, on the show. Incredible.
Oh, yeah.
You've had Dr. Coa on several times. Mm-hmm. Christopher Ferguson, Patrick Markey. You had the inaugural guest on this show, Dr. Chrissy Cook, I think just after she'd graduated. Nick Yee, Dr. Raphael Boccamozzo, or Dr. B, as he's fondly known in the Take This community, Dr. Anthony Bean, Dr. Ryan Kelly. You did a trio episode. It stands out because it was a great one with Dr. Stephanie Orme, Dr. Emery S. Daniel, and Dr. Ariane Fichot. That was great. Dr. Kelly Dunlap as well. Like, I could go on. I really could.
Yeah. No, I'm really happy that those people chose to come on as well. So I've had a lot of good luck getting people to come on and talk about what they do.
It's a great show. It's worth pointing that out. It's genuinely a very good podcast.
Well,
even Dr. Barrett B. Anderson, I think that was it. That was a great episode. That actually really impacted what I'm actually studying in my PhD. One of those light bulb moments of, I could use this. This is genius. I'm going to look at this.
As actual application to the real world. That's incredible.
I know, right? Like, there we go. Magic. So yeah, you mentioned you have a great intro. You said it so casually. Oh, I've put out a couple of books on the subject, you know. Tell us about those. Let's talk about that a little bit more.
Yeah, so the first one was called Getting Gamers, The Psychology of Video Games and Their Impact on the People Who Play Them. And that came out a few years ago at this point, but it was really sort of a, let's take like the greatest hits from the website, the articles that I had written, you know, some of the big topics around there, like, you know, achievements and motivation and the effects of games on people and nostalgia and avatars and all those kinds of things. And then like blow it out to chapter length examinations where I went back to the well and did more research and sort of had more space in each chapter to play with. So each chapter is a question like, you know, why do we grind in games? What effect, you know, do we control our avatars or do they have effects on us?
You might say these are the big questions.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, a lot of questions that like people had come up or that I had researched or people, you know, had asked me. So each chapter is like, it tries to answer a question about, you know, why games are designed the way they are, why we behave as we do when we play them, and why they're marketed and sold as they are. And that one has had a lot of success. You know, it's not like I made it to the New York Times bestseller list or anything, but it's had a real long tail. And I've heard of people teachers, professors, et cetera, using it as a text in some of their game design classes and psychology classes as well. So that's like amazing to hear. That is sort of, in a lot of ways, the highest compliment that I think a lot of, you know, people could pay, is that they put this in front of students who are going to be doing this sort of thing for a living and want them to get something out of it. So that's great. So that one has kind of been a perennial. And then more recently published in 2020, second book called The Engagement Game, Why Your Workplace Culture Should Look More Like a Video Game. So that came out more recently. And that one sort of more explicitly has tied together industrial organizational psychology and video games. So, you know, I have a PhD in psychology, and specifically industrial organizational psychology, or IO psychology, sometimes just called organizational psychology or occupational or work psychology, where we study psychology in the workplace. So, you know, how do people work and lead in organizations of different kinds? And that has always been sort of my day jobs, my area of expertise, specifically, you know, what my degree was in. But since starting to do the psychologyofgames.com and the first book, you know, I had expanded out into other areas. But for this one, I wanted to kind of look and see, like, if you were a manager or a leader of some other kind in an organization, like, what could you learn from good game design to help you do that job better? So how can you, like, motivate people? How can you reward them? How can you get them to set goals? How can you get them to learn from failure and accept hardships as a way of learning, you know, have like a grit and a growth mindset and, you know, an attitude that helps them set goals where they're going to be difficult and they may not succeed at first, but they'll get feedback and they'll want to learn from that. Like, how do you build cultures that you want in an organization? Like, all these kinds of questions are answered by the IO psychology, you know, literature. And they also are answered by, you know, the precepts of good game design and good community management in the video game space. So it was a lot of fun to like tie those together. And, you know, if you're a young or even an older manager who is real familiar with video games, then you might find like some interesting new ways to conceptualize and think about those lessons and apply them to your work as well.
And you would think that, you know, we're going to get to a point where most managers do also play games. I mean, games are the most popular hobby ever with billions of players. And that's not even an estimate. That's figures, facts that I've referenced previously, but billions of players.
For sure.
I know you've been quite big on it yourself, but it goes beyond, you know, badges, leaderboards, and that other one I've forgotten. But it's points, yeah. So it's about going beyond that. So you write books. That's great. I think it's also worth saying that while you do also host a podcast, unlike, I don't know, some Wild West entertainers in the podcast space, looks itself, you actually write articles to accompany the episodes. Yeah. You write an article, then you interview someone in that space. How can you sort of walk us through like how you managed to start that as a... Because now, you know, the podcast has been going for a few years, but you entered the sort of content creation, finger quotes, space quite early for someone also from a science background. How was that starting out?
Yeah, so I started the website back in 2009-ish. I think like late 2009 was when I put the first article up. So I had been, you know, as I mentioned, I'm IO psychologist by training, but I always been interested in other areas of psychology as well. And, you know, doing reading around these various other, you know, social psychology and judgment decision making and communications and consumer psychology, all these kinds of things. And I kept sort of realizing, like, well, this can explain like why video games are made the way they are. This can explain like structures in video games around reward systems, for example, or this could explain why we react to teammates as we do when we play video, you know, multiplayer video games, or this is why we compete or not in different kinds of video games. And kept like thinking about how all this kind of stuff came up, because I played games my whole life. It was a habit from childhood that I never gave up. I was an arcade rat in my childhood, hanging out in the coin operated days, and then moved into PC gaming, you know, in my teens, and then console and everything. Now, you know, I play on whatever I can get my hands on. So I was also, you know, interested in video games and saw this like, well, I could sort of just combine these two things, and decided to throw up a blog, since it was the days of blogs before that whole platform kind of went away for the most part, or at least wasn't as popular as it was then. And decided to, you know, hey, look, psychologyofgames.com domain is available. I'll register that, throw up a WordPress site. And I think I launched with like 5 articles, you know, just kind of put them out one after another to prime the pump. And my idea was that this would just be kind of an experiment, something I did, because I'm kind of like that, where I will just serially pick up a new hobby or decide to try something out or get interested in something, you know, whether it's like photography or, you know, writing, creating a blog or doing any of this sort of stuff. And to my surprise, like a lot of people started like commenting on the articles and reaching out to me, especially like game developers, people working in the games industry, but also just like people who are just interested in thinking about games in a little bit more rigorous fashion, with a little bit more of a scientific bent, given the psychology angle. So I just kept doing it, you know, putting out article every couple of weeks, every month or so, and did that for years and years, and then decided to leverage that into the first book, Getting Gamers. And then once I was done with the manuscript for that, I decided like, hey, I should start a podcast, because, and it was like right about the time everybody was pivoting to video. So maybe I was like a few steps behind again. Decided to do that. And like about the time that the book came out, I created the podcast, because partially because it was like a way to help promote the book, and my publisher, you know, wanted me to do that. But then I also found that I greatly enjoyed it, and it was a great way to get other people to do the work for me, because I just, you know, get them on a call and say, hey, tell me about this thing that you, this study you did, or this thing that you do on your job, and let them talk. Found out that was a lot of fun as well. So, you know, it was just really finding something that piqued my interest. I saw that not a lot of people were doing this particular angle, especially at the time. You know, they weren't talking about video games in this sort of quasi-academic way, or academic way. And I actually later then kind of went back and found out that that wasn't true, that there actually were people like doing real academic research on video games or adjacent to that, and applying, you know, the findings to video games. I just wasn't aware of it, because I wasn't like looking for it. But once I started, you know, hitting Google and hitting article indexes and databases for academic research and started finding this stuff, it was like, oh, cool. I'm like, this is out there. So my mission then sort of became to popularize it, to help share the stuff that people was doing, and then find out how I could apply, you know, non-video game research that's just about psychology in general, and apply it to game design and player behavior.
I think I said the same thing to Dr. Cole when I spoke to her, but I kind of need to say, in a weird way, I said like, thank you for what you do, because it makes people like me who want to do what I do much easier. The fact that you sort of even, you know, you rounded up all those people onto that podcast, which gave me an extensive reference list before I even started my PhD.
So what you're saying is I should charge for access to that stuff. Got it. Okay.
I mean, if you're not monopolizing on your like leisure time, are you doing life right? That's what the internet tells me. Like,
yeah.
Like, you know, if you play D&D, you and your friends should all film it, because that's a way you can make money out of it. Like, don't do anything ever just for fun. If you play games, stream it. Like,
it's content. It's wasted content, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Like, and then TikTok chop bits of all of that up into TikTok, and that's how it's done, right?
Yeah, but it's interesting. Like, I never thought of like that as a resource, but because I was just building it like one name at a time, one episode at a time. But, you know, when you look back, and I think I've got 70 episodes, because I don't do them like weekly or anything. I aim for like one episode a month to keep things manageable. But yeah, it's a pretty good list of like, you know, who has been doing research and who's been talking and who's been doing work in this area.
No, it's great. I have to ask though. I've got like a more sort of general work question, but I have to ask: is there anyone who you're itching to have on the Psychology of Games podcast?
You know, honestly, like I think I've hit a lot of the big names. There's like Jane McGonigal is sort of like the one remaining big name out there.
Did Reality is Broken, Why Video Games Are Good for Us?
Yeah. She's published at least a couple of books. Reality is Broken is probably the best known one about video games and like mental health and recovery and building resilience. That's what that book in particular was about. But she's talked about lots of different stuff. I think I might have reached out to her once or twice, but she probably gets a lot of inquiries these days, and I haven't filtered to the top. So that's probably like one name. And I kind of wish that I could talk to more practitioners, mm-hmm. like people who are working in game studios, developers, publishers, community managers, that kind of stuff, who are leveraging this kind of stuff or even have like a background in psychology. Those are great episodes when I can land those people, but a lot of times they're just like, I can't like talk about, you know, stuff that I do for work specifically, you know, to the public, in general, not just me. So they're kind of hard to like land because they've got certain restrictions about them.
That's fair. I also have to ask, and I know this is a cheeky question, but have you got a favorite episode?
Gosh, I don't think so. Nothing is like coming to mind. I think like some of my favorite topics, you know, the answer to that question probably because the topic was particularly interesting to me, not necessarily, you know, that.
No shade on the guests.
Yeah. But, you know, it's like I'm really interested when we start to pair like mechanics, like game mechanics with psychology specifically. So, you know, there's episodes around like achievements and what effects those have and why do they work, for example. And different like genres and motivations to play different genres of games. That stuff's fascinating. So like where it gets down to like the real mechanical stuff, I always find most interesting, which is another reason why I want to talk to like more practitioners, right? Because they'll get like specific and down in the weeds of like, oh, you know, we designed this level, you know, like I had an episode about the psychology of level design and mm-hmm. like why you create spaces the way you do. That stuff is really fascinating because it's nuts and bolts. And I think it's really useful for other people doing that kind of work too. Is like, listen to that, take notes, and then directly go experiment with it on their job.
Mm-hmm. So have you got anything that you're sort of doing presently? Anything that you sort of maybe give us a sneak peek about? Like what's sort of next for your work? Oh, again, fishing a little bit here, but.
Yeah. So I took some time the beginning of this year to work ahead. So I've got like articles for the rest of the year, like in the can that I don't want to give away, but you know, I'm doing one article a month and one podcast episode a month going forward for the rest of this year, which is the schedule that I've always, you know, kind of tried to maintain to, like I said, keep things manageable, keep things fresh and not run out of topics to talk about without going too much back into previous topics. And one of the reasons that I did that work ahead is to free up some more of my time because I'm trying to get a new book out there. So my agent is currently shopping around a proposal for a book that's a lot like Getting Gamers, where it's the psychology of video games. And I sort of answer questions about why do we do things or why is this designed the way that this is. But instead of video games, it's about like Dungeons and Dragons and tabletop role-playing games.
Oh, snap.
Which is, another interest of mine that I play in two games a week currently. I've been playing pretty solidly for like the last 12 years and played a bunch of earlier editions when I was a kid. So in addition to video games, that's the other kind of game that I enjoy. And like video games, you know, back when I wrote Getting Gamers, I think that there's a lot of interesting questions to be answered about tabletop role-playing games, but different questions, right? Because they're a different experience. It's not as designed as video games are. You know, it's much more open-ended. It's much more collaborative, flexible, and so forth. But there are a lot of interesting questions that psychological research can help us answer. And D&D in particular and tabletop role-playing games in general are like having this huge explosion of popularity. Like Wizards of the Coast last year, I think they reported like over $1 billion in revenue, which they had never done, you know, anywhere near those numbers before. And like with the pandemic that happened in the last couple of years and ongoing, you know, people have started to play more, but they've been doing it like virtually through, you know, virtual tabletop things and Zoom calls and Discord servers and that kind of stuff. So there's a lot of interesting stuff going on there, but it's hugely popular, you know, in the last few years, and it seems like it's just going to keep growing. So there's a great market. So, hey, if you're a publisher, out there, get in touch with me. I'll put you in touch with my agent and we can talk about the possibility of publishing this book.
Contact information. You
know, I've been working on that.
Contact information wherever you find this episode. It'll be attached.
Yeah. Yeah. So I've been writing that book and researching that book, most recently. In addition to doing the occasional, you know, article when inspiration hits me and trying to get ahead on the podcast recordings as well.
So it's interesting you mentioned that because I know you've spoken to Adam Johns and Adam Davis. Apologies for pronouncing that wrong.
Game to Grow.
Dr. Megan Cornell as well. And there's kind of this...
Clinical role, yeah.
I've had this great discussion with a couple of those people actually on a panel a few weeks back. And one of the sort of big points is that with video games, you can take a lot out of them. You can find a lot in games and then pull that out and relate that to inwardly almost. But with TTRPGs, it's you putting into that world. And I think that's one of the big distinctions. I'm actually really new to TTRPGs myself. I only started playing last year. It's funny that you mentioned it's kind of boomed because, I mean, the world being in a really crappy state and then people wanting to explore to fantasy worlds where things are not as crappy. I know correlation doesn't equal causation, but you know what I mean?
Yeah. There's some hay to be made, I think, there. There's some things to find out. And kind of coinciding along with it, this... You know, Critical Role is like a behemoth, and it is arguably bigger than Dungeons and Dragons, right? In a way, like it has millions and millions of concurrent viewers, people that watch the YouTube videos of these people playing essentially a Dungeons and Dragons campaign, these professional voice actors. And it's huge, and it's bringing in more people to the hobby than any marketing effort on Wizards of the Coast part. And that's kind of coincided with this rise of streaming and these sort of parasocial relationships that we have with streamers where we feel like we know them, but it's mostly a one-way communication, but not entirely. Like there are ways to like go back and forth. You know, you're probably not going to have much luck getting the Critical Role people to respond to your comment and chat during their stream, but like smaller groups of doing let's plays or actual play streams, that may be the case. So there's a lot of really cool research going on around streaming and watching people play games as well, both in video games and tabletop games.
I mean, I'll be really honest. I might be about to embarrass myself on the internet, not for the first time, but I like only really recently learned what Critical Role was. Like I'd heard of it. I'd even heard of, and this is how you know you've peaked as a person, the Matt Mercer effect. Like I'd heard that phrase before and I was like, what is this?
Right.
And then looked it up and was like, ah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
So huge.
Yeah, so I'm hoping the book can address a lot of that stuff and help people be better either DMs, you know, dungeon masters or players of any kind, really. So it's not self-help, but it's going to be like, here's the research, here's how you can apply this to your game.
Excellent. So let's talk about TTRPGs then, because I'd love to hear some of your take on it. What sort of stuff have you played? I've only played D&D 5e and Dune, Adventures in the Imperium. They're the only two I've played, so...
Yeah, I'm mainly a D&D person as well, and that's mainly because all my friends that play play it as well. I played like a little bit of the Call of Cthulhu game, a little bit of the Star Wars RPG game, which I found really enjoyable too, because it's kind of more a focus on storytelling. But yeah, those are the ones that I played, and D&D is by far and away the one that I play, and it's by far and away the most popular one too in the market. As well in the public consciousness, but who knows, maybe that'll change.
Maybe this will be something that's in the book, but it's like classic question of when you create a D&D character, did you sort of try and embody a lot of yourself in the character, or was the character the antithesis of yourself?
Yeah, I'm going to explore that, and I haven't really started that research, and it might vary a lot from person to person is my intuition. For more experienced players who have made lots of characters and played lots of game, you know, it's probably going to be more around like mechanics. Like, okay, I want to play like this type of character, and I want them to have these, you know, I want it to be this race and this class and have these feats and this background, because that's all going to be sort of give me the mechanical results that I want. But even once you have that and you decide how to role play the character, or new players who are just coming to it and don't know enough about the mechanics to pull those kind of stunts, there might be some interesting stuff going on there around, yeah, do I create like an idealized version of myself? Do I create something that is totally different and that gives me an opportunity to role play and explore and sort of safely experiment with different ways of interacting with people and being a different person? Does that happen? When it happens, like how do you go about doing it, and what effects does it have? If you wanted that to happen at your table, how could you encourage that? If you were the dungeon master or a fellow player, how could you encourage that sort of stuff to happen? Because I know like a lot of people use D&D in therapy right now as like a therapeutic tool, where they will sit with groups of people or even one-on-one and, you know, play out the game and then help them say like, okay, here's your opportunity to experiment with being more assertive, or your opportunity to experiment with being, with practicing your executive functioning skills of like planning and prioritizing and thinking things through before you act. Here's your chance to, you know, work on your communication skills and anxiety, you know, reduce anxiety by giving you a safer environment for that sort of stuff. So whether or not people like do it on purpose, there's also the question of like, well, could it be done, you know, as a therapeutic tool as well, which is definitely going to be a chapter that I examine. And there's lots of experts out there at this point that are doing that kind of thing.
So one of the things I always like to, I like to pretend is the USP of the show, but it's not really, it's sort of going, okay, so they're all the things you do, but what was it that motivated you to do that? You know, you've mentioned you had a background in sort of occupational psychology, that's how I know it. What was it that made you really go, okay, well, this, what was that drive?
I've always liked to write, you know, I enjoy writing. And so doing the blog and starting off that way was like an easy way for me to, and that's essentially what it was in the beginning, was like a blogging phase, I guess, or just an opportunity to like write and have something structured to say, and try to put it out there for an audience. And when it caught on and there were a few people reading it, then that encouraged me to keep doing it and, you know, sort of keep exploring. And then hand in hand with that, it was just an opportunity to like keep learning about like these different corners of the psychology field, because it's a very large and diverse field. You know, you have organizational psychology, clinical psychology, consumer decision making, you know, all of these different areas of psychology. And then that's not even getting into like sort of neighboring fields like communication studies, economics, medicine, even, you know, I've had guests in all of those fields on the podcast and have read their stuff for writing articles or book chapters. So, you know, it's kind of that combination of like, well, I like to write and I need something to write about, that I'm not just writing for myself. And then an excuse to satisfy my stupid curiosity, I guess, around these kinds of things as well. Like, you know, an impetus, a reason, a justification, for buying another book or downloading another paper, to read.
Yeah. Yeah. I understand that. So, you know, we talked about work, but the other side of this coin is, what do you get up to when you're not working?
This may shock you, but I play games.
Stop the presses. Whoa, yeah. But you have time to play games?
Yeah, I squeeze it in here and there. Yeah, usually nights, weekends, that kind of stuff. But yeah, I mean, yeah, I play video games. Like I mentioned, I've got three different D&D games that I'm in, and which means like two sessions a week, since two of them are like alternating weekends. So that sort of stuff. And like the cool thing is that in one of those D&D games, my daughter plays with me, and she's actually the one that got me the invite to the group. It was a group that she was in with a friend, and the father-in-law was the DM for it, and they had a couple of players leave, and my daughter was like, hey, my dad's into this kind of stuff, why don't we like get him in? So it's like a mix of teenagers and adults in that game. And like I've always played games with my kids too. I have two daughters, and some of their earliest memories are playing things like Minecraft, you know, on the Xbox and the PC with me. We would collaborate on that kind of stuff. So, you know, it's fun to fit it in with family. My wife's not a gamer. She never has been. She tried. It just didn't click with her. So, you know, I said, okay, well, if you're not going to be a gamer, I'm just going to build a couple from scratch myself.
Never mind, you know, like
being my kids.
Never mind. How do we teach the children? You just went, no, this is it. Sorry. Yep.
No, sit down. You're going to learn about Minecraft today.
Nice.
So they both play games. The older one plays a lot of like competitive shooters, like, you know, like Overwatch and, those, and there's into like Genshin Impact as well. Both of them were into that one. But the younger one plays like a lot of casual games, and she went through a Roblox phase where she could like build her own stuff, and she'll spend hours just like building houses in like some Roblox game and doing like interior design for that kind of stuff. And then she actually went through a Valorant phase as well, where she got frighteningly good at that game. It's another competitive first-person shooter, online shooter. And I would like watch over her shoulder. I was like, oh my gosh, like the reflexes of a 14-year-old cannot be underestimated for that kind of stuff.
So I feel like, again, this is a slightly perhaps strange question, but it's funny you mention that because, again, it's purely parasocial. But like in the podcast, you kind of time capsule a bit of this, and you kind of mentioned the various things that you yourself or your daughters have been playing.
Oh yeah.
Basically, sort of like, how does that feel to have that time capsule? But have you seen sort of like any real changes in what they've played, and has that impacted what you've played or vice versa?
Yeah, I mean, they went through phases where they were more or less, you know, into certain games and into certain types of games. I mean, it has been interesting to look back, and I've got like old, you know, photos and screen captures of us, you know, playing games where I've got, I think, hanging downstairs near where the console setup is, like a picture of my daughter standing in front of the TV where we had 100%ed Lego Harry Potter. One of the Lego Harry Potter games was like, you know, one of the few games that I've gotten like every single achievement for. And we had played that like co-op throughout the whole thing. So yeah, some great memories, and sort of see them evolving, coming in and out of the hobby. Like the older one doesn't play a whole lot of those kind of games anymore. She's like more into Dungeons and Dragons, and she plays Genshin Impact, like I mentioned, on her like iPad. But she has kind of fallen out of it and taken on other interests. And the younger one is playing a lot more as well. Like, a lot of the social games now, but also like Valorant and Genshin and doing those designing games and sort of like just designing spaces.
I think it's kind of funny. I mean, you mentioned this, like she plays on like her iPad. There's still part of my brain that doesn't comprehend just how many games you can get on like mobile now. Like it blows my mind, honestly. Given that, like, you know, I kind of grew up with like the NES and SNES, and like it was always like, oh, this was the games console, this was the thing that played the games, and it was stuck to the TV. Like, I love like the DS. I think was probably, I mean, I know the Switch is technically handheld, but there's a reason there were different versions of the DS and they didn't deviate. You know, it's just, and to be able to play games that were that good, you know, portably, you can play Final Fantasy VII on your mobile now. That's wild. Like,
never mind like remote play options like with some of the consoles as well. Yeah,
you stream a game from your console to your phone. That's
it's, and I lived through, you know, the launch of those kinds of platforms and saw the mobile game scene grow up and change. And there was like a moment when, you know, I had like not even an iPhone, it was like an iPod Touch. Which was basically like it just played music and did apps, but it had like the touch screen and everything. It wasn't like a phone. You couldn't connect to the internet through a browser or chat or anything.
I love that, like, you've had to define that, and because there were people that don't know what an iPod Touch is.
Yeah,
I've still got my old iPod Touch 4. I still use it only for music at this point, because you can't get apps on it. But like, yeah, like, yeah. I remember when they came out, it was huge. It was like, whoa, you can have games and things on it. Like, what?
And there was a moment where, like, well, this is going to be great. There's going to be so many cool games, because they were making games under, like, the old model of, you know, like, you pay $5 and you own this game and you play through it. And then sort of over time, that morphed into, like, where the free-to-play models and the freemium models took over, and games as service, you know, sort of moved from there into other spaces. And, you know, I don't like those kinds of free-to-play games. I don't play them. They don't make good use of my time. They're not respectful of my time and so forth. But, you know, I'm not going to be like a gatekeeper and say that like those aren't video games or those people aren't real gamers. Of course they are. And you're right. It's just amazing that everybody has like this incredibly powerful gaming platform that they carry around with them and they'll take out when they're stuck in line or waiting for a flight, or, you know, just they're lying in bed, you know, just to kill a little bit of time.
It really is like frighteningly baffling yet amazing. It really, really is. And I think the thing for me is that I hard agree with you on the philosophy there, that my kind of view for games is that for every pound that I spend on it, I want to get an hour's gameplay. Because I sound like a really grumpy old man, but like during like the mid sort of noughties, sort of into the early 2010s, we started to see the shift of like, you'd get a £40, $50 game come out, and then you'd be able to get like map expansions on like your Xbox Gold, and that for me was like where you saw this big shift of, well, everything is actually all about the multiplayer. The single player campaign is like 6 hours, play it on all the difficulties, but play online, that's where we want to see you. And I've always been, I like single player games though. That's why I play big JRPGs that are 100 hours long, because they're great value for money. Like, you know.
Yeah.
And freemium games kind of have that, like, they're either pay to win or, like, as you say, like, it's just, oh yeah, well, you've run out of lives because RNG, so play for more of them. And I'm like, no thanks.
Yeah, the energy mechanic, like, nope, you played too much today. You can either pay to play some more or come back tomorrow. I'm like, okay, uninstall. I don't want that. But a lot of people do, and a lot of people play them just enough to make that sort of thing appealing and fun. So, hey, more power to them, more power to the developers.
I think it's one of them. Like, I already have, I don't like to say I have free time, because, you know, I'm a PhD researcher. So I have, like, non-work time. And, you know, I don't need a game to regulate how much I can play, because I already know I have very limited time to play.
Right.
I might have, like, an hour, and I want to try and squeeze as much out of that hour as possible. Like, I think, I mean, I actually paid for Rocket League when you could buy it back in the day, because I enjoy Rocket League immensely. And even in a game like that, where you have old codgers like me who bought it, there is still that pay to win model. You know, the payable cars have slightly better hitboxes and all like the hidden stats and things like that. Because I mean, you've done a great episode on it. You know, like, how would you feel if you paid to win or you got beat by someone who paid to win? Because I always say I don't,
or had them on your team as a teammate.
Yeah, like, because if I just get beat by someone who's better than me in Rocket League, it's like, well, you're just better than me. I respect that. But if you get someone who like just nicks something all the time because they've got that slightly bigger hitbox, that's where I get frustrated.
Yeah, and it's all about perception there too, and how the developers and people who are in charge of things like UI and marketing and pricing and all that sort of stuff can frame that information or surface it or not, and whether or not rumors, you know, take off or people say like, look, I've done the math, this car has a better hitbox and can increase your win rate by 0.04% or whatever.
I mean, it's less than 0.05, yeah. So it must be worth it.
That's true. It's
psychology jokes, let's go.
The confidence interval does not contain zero, so we're
flying. Flying. I think for me, like with games like that, like I enjoyed Overwatch immensely, but again, in relation to like A, backlog and B, time, there was this kind of like I struggle to be able to get back into it, because like the training against the AI was just nowhere near playing PvP, and like you rack up levels and then you get put into these really high level games and I'm just awful, and then I'm just like, well, it's not for me.
Yeah, funny you should mention Overwatch. I still play it. That's like my go-to game whenever I have like 30 minutes and I just want to play a little something, and I'll jump into the casual mode, because the competitive mode is like just too toxic. Like there's just too many tryhards and people there that will yell at you for what they perceive as mistakes. But in like the casual quick play modes, it's still pretty enjoyable for me, and I can still have a good time. But yeah, you do get matched in, and I don't know, sometimes I suspect that like all of those bronze level players are smurfs who are like, you know, retired pros from the Overwatch League or something that are going in there and just created these new accounts and are just enjoy stomping people like me. But yeah, I have enough fun.
I mean, games being fun, but that's a strange concept.
Yeah, for some people.
That's a nice little segue then into, have you been playing anything recently? That question was not taken from any other podcast that might ask any similar or other questions. Similarities are on accident.
Right. It has been all Elden Ring all the time, almost, for me, since it came out in February. It's been all that I've been playing. And I bought it twice as well. So like I bought it on the PS5 originally, because that's where I like to play those kind of games, you know, on the big TV and sitting back on the couch. Mm-hmm. But then like a couple of the guys that I have like a Tuesday night kind of online PC gaming, you know, standing meeting with those guys, who are not the kind of people that normally play games like Elden Rings. Like they'd never played any of the Dark Souls games. Like they both picked it up and they're like, hey, let's play. So I'm like, okay, fine. So I'll buy it on Steam, like start over with them. So I haven't actually beaten the game yet. Like I haven't seen credits or beaten the final boss. One, because I keep going back and like creating new characters and like replaying the early parts of the game as well, which, you know, Elden Ring is not an MMO, but that's something that you see a lot of MMO players do. They have altitis where they go back and create alternate characters. And then in that Tuesday night PC gaming group, like we will help each other. So we will like go into each other's worlds and do cooperatives. So it's kind of like taking three times as long to progress the main quest storyline for that, because we keep going back and forth and helping each other get along. But that's a lot of fun. To do that. So Elden Ring is definitely the answer to your question.
Fair enough. I feel like I have to ask. So would you describe yourself as a pro gamer for being able to play games such as Elden Ring?
No. Yeah, no. A lot of people played those kind of games. A lot of people have beat them that aren't like incredibly good gamers. They have a reputation for being really hard and punishing, because they are. Like you have to be deliberate about them, and you have to sort of learn and do things right, but they're not. I mean, I've played harder games than Dark Souls, and Elden Ring in particular is much more approachable even than a lot of the Dark Souls games. It's still difficult. You'll still get stomped if you are careless, but it's doable.
Okay, so imagine just like that moment of all the reporter microphones appear, and like, games harder than Dark Souls? Please tell us more.
I mean, I'm talking about like the super masochist games like Super Meat Boy or Ori and the Blind Forest. Like that one was really hard for me for some reason. Like those types of games that are just built around being punishing and difficult. I tried Spelunky once.
Oh,
maybe, you know what? Maybe I'm just bad at platformers. I'm like naming all these games off. They're just like traditional 2D platformers for the most part. And I'm just bad at those. I never had my formative like Mario years. Okay. I was a PC gamer during that time and only kind of went to consoles later. But yeah, there's some that are harder, and a lot of like online games as well have really steep learning curves. Try going on to League of Legends as a new player, for example, and that is going to be a difficult experience.
I'd love your take then, and I know this is a bit of a hot topic. It was a big thing around Elden Ring. You've used the term gatekeeping already. I actually said this. This is going to, I'm breaking the fourth wall, but I've recorded another one of these that's going to go out after this one, where I discuss this a little bit. Okay. But like for me, Elden Ring, you know, there's a lot of people that sort of take this narrative of, I like the fact that the game is hard, the fact that it makes me want to cry and drives me to tears and frustration is good. I kind of sit back and go like, maybe we need to take 5 minutes and talk about our emotional regulation, because like feeling emotion at narrative is fine, but getting to a point where you want to split your controller in half is maybe not the best. You know, like in my opinion, like, you know, and the games that frustrate me the most, like football games, like, sorry, soccer games for those in the US. Because I, you know, I'm English, I'm from Liverpool. Yeah. We love football, soccer. So I've racked up the most hours in those, but I get no more frustrated. I'm tempted to use the word aggressive for a joke, but like those games would have me scoring high on the aggression scales more than any other. And I just think, yeah, it's good. Games should have challenge. You know, failure is a part of success. It's a thing of life, right? But it's just really interesting that there is this narrative of no, like it shouldn't have an easy mode because that would ruin the game. Whereas for me, it goes back to what I was saying before. I tried playing Dark Souls. I just didn't have enough time to get the mastery to get good. And people say, well, just grind. And I'm like, well, I've got an hour. If I just do that grinding, I'm not going to enjoy myself as much as playing something else. Your take on that as a perspective, I guess. That was not a question.
Yeah. I mean, play what you enjoy, right? Like, if you're having a bad experience and it's not getting any better, then like you don't have to prove anything. You don't owe anyone anything to keep having that negative experience, and go and play something that you enjoy more for whatever reason. 100%, totally agree with you there. And yeah, I think a lot of those people just enjoy the extreme challenge of those kinds of games, and they enjoy like the bragging rights that come with, you know, beating those games or doing something even more extreme, like a soul level one completion of a game, which is where you play all the way through one of those games without leveling your character up. And, you know, you're just level one for the whole time. And then go on Twitch and look on YouTube and you'll find people doing even crazier stuff. Like, I'm going to play this whole game without ever taking a single hit. Like, if any enemy, any boss hits me once, then that's the end of the run. You know, I start over. And those sort of extreme challenges are there, but they're for a teeny tiny sliver of the audience, right? Streamers and speedrunners. For the most part, who want to do that sort of stuff for an audience and for the notoriety. But yeah, I agree. If you're not, all games are for all people, and if you're not enjoying it, then there's games is such a huge thing these days, and surely you can find something else to do with your time. Go do something unrelated to games with your time. Go watch a TV show, read a book, work on, you know, a project of some other kind, do whatever it is that you like. I think a lot of that discussion for Elden Ring has come out because the developers have put things in to make it like more accessible to people. It's still like difficult, and there's still things that you'll go into unprepared and you'll get smeared, but You know, there's the summoning system where you can summon NPCs and other players to help you. That's kind of always been in the games. There's summons for like these monsters that you can summon in with your spirit ashes that is kind of like an AI controlled companion to go in to make it easier. It's an open world game, so you have more opportunities and more diverse opportunities to like go grind and just get out level the challenge and, mm-hmm. and come in, because the higher level you are, the tougher you are, and you can upgrade your weapons and all that stuff and make those challenges less challenging. And I think some longtime Dark Souls Soulsborne players don't appreciate that for whatever reason, because it takes away sort of like the cachet that comes with beating one of these games in that way, or at least that's their perception. You know, to which I say, like, well, whatever, you can still play the game without summoning, you can still do your soul level one, you know, playthrough, you can still have all of these challenges in place. It doesn't have to be imposed on you. You can do it yourself.
Yeah, because, I mean, you know, challenge runs have always been a thing. I mean, like, the furthest I've gone is I've done a challenge run of Final Fantasy VII, you know, but, like, you can, the features of the game, by the most part, are optional. You don't have to use them. And my opinion on, like, the Elden Ring shouldn't have an easy mode is, like, but if you don't use it, what difference does it make? If you really want to be pedantic, like, turn achievements off, maybe, if you think that would take away from that prestige, yeah, maybe. But, like, just play to have fun. Like, you can boot up a vanilla, quote-unquote, copy of Final Fantasy VII and choose just not to use X, Y, and Z. And then it's a challenge, yeah, right? So, if it exists in the game as an option, it's an option.
And Dark Souls has always kind of had an easy mode. It's just been extremely gradual to activate it, because you activate it by leveling up, right? So the more you grind, the more you, you know, upgrade your stuff, your weapons and armor and et cetera, in some versions of the game, then like the easier it gets, like the less hard those enemies hit. And yeah, you may still hit like some walls, like Ornstein and Smaug, or Ornstein and Smaug, in Dark Souls was like an infamous wall where a lot of people just couldn't get through that boss fight, you know, no matter how they prepared for it. But for the most part, yeah, it does. It always has like an easier mode where you just sort of grind things out. But that kind of goes back to your point about like, well, I don't have the time to play for 60 hours before this game gets like approachable. Which is like, okay, you know, understood. But that's the experience. And then FromSoft has actually sort of made that less of an issue with Elden Ring by giving you other options right out of the gate or soon thereafter.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, that's really interesting points. I think, obviously we agree, so it's kind of like, yeah, of course, that makes complete sense, because you should be able to enjoy what you want. But I just kind of think it's almost like interesting that people just have this other view, almost like with a staunch, like, this is how it should be perspective without reason. Like,
yeah.
Like, why can we not just enjoy things? Like,
right. And I'm enjoying it. Yeah. It's a great game.
And so good, you're enjoying it twice.
Yeah. Yeah, it's probably my favorite game series, too. Like, I've played and beaten the Dark Souls and Bloodborne games multiple times, each of them.
Nice.
So I was hyped when this came out.
That's, I mean,
and now like the backlog is stacking up. There's like a bunch of, you know, coming out that I want to play.
So many games, not enough time. So many games. Let's talk about some sort of blue sky ideas. I like to sort of, as we begin the sort of nether part of the podcast. Again. Any similarity to other podcast questions is purely coincidental. But I've had a lot of people on the podcast, not just researchers. So I would say, if you had like no limitations at all, you had complete access to funds, resources, people, space, time, you know, what would you do? What if you had no limitations whatsoever, what would be the one thing you'd like to do? That maybe passion project, that maybe piece of research, what would it be?
Yeah. I would probably write for a living. You know, like write nonfiction stuff, more of that, sure. But try my hand at like writing fiction. You know, if I could call in Rich to work tomorrow, and not not have to work anymore. Like that would be the sort of stuff, and just have the ability to fail at that or take as long as I needed to get good at it and work through it. You know, it was like what I thought I was going to do when I was like a little kid. I think after astronaut, and I gave up that dream. I was like, I'd like to write for a living, be the kind of person that creates all these books that I like to read.
Any genre of fiction you'd like to delve into?
You know, I probably like genre of fiction of some kind, fantasy, sci-fi, horror, that kind of stuff. Probably.
I would say that my favorite genre of book is probably sci-fi dystopia.
Okay.
Just well, like
this has been a good, what, last 20 years for you. That's been a very popular genre. Yeah.
I was listening to the audiobook. I use read interchangeably because accessibility is important. Sure. But I read The Stand by Stephen King in 2020. That was terrifying on multiple levels.
A lot of other people. Yeah.
So I definitely sci-fi fantasy. I'd read it.
Okay. Well, there you go. I have one buyer, guaranteed. I'll build from there.
Yeah. Would you ever be interested in like writing like a D&D module or something?
Yeah.
If you haven't already, like the DM's Guild exists.
Yeah, it does, and it's easier than ever to self-publish that kind of stuff and get it noticed and get it in front of people. So that's always an option. Might do that, you know, after this project that I'm working on now, that might be fun to do. I've DM'd a lot in the past, and I usually take like an existing, you know, campaign setting or module and then just completely wreck it, adding my own twist to it and changing this or that, just because it seems less work than creating something from scratch, but more fun than following it rotely, you know, to the letter.
Mm-hmm. Out of interest then, I ask because I've recently started GMing a June game with a couple of friends. I've never GM'd before. Mm-hmm. I've played a little bit of D&D 5e. For me, the biggest difference has been, as a player, you're like, I'm going to do something that the GM doesn't expect. That's my aim, for us to succeed.
Yeah, DMs love that.
Then as a GM, I'm like, right, this is the module. I've maybe laced a little bit of homebrew in here, there. I'm definitely going to expect them to do this. And then they just go white Wild West, just add into another country. And I'm just like, I did not think you would do that.
Yeah. And kind of one thing that I've experienced both as a player and a DM, like the best moments are when players come up with something weird like that. And the DM is just like, yes, that works. Let's go. Let's find out where this goes. Cause it's collaborative storytelling, right? Like the DM or the GM is not the only one there, like setting up a story and telling a story. Like they're putting the pieces in play and the players are shoving them around to see what happens. And it's a story creation engine that is collaborative. And sort of the more you can get your head around that, I think the more fun you can have with the group. The drawback is that it does require a certain amount of improv and extemporaneous, like let's just go with it and figure this out kind of thinking, as opposed to like, let's plan this out and you guys are going to check off a bunch of boxes that I've set up for you.
Mm-hmm. Ye old rule of cool, as it were.
That's right. Yeah. The rule of cool should be in play in every game, in my opinion.
Out of interest then, do you have a preference between DMing or playing, if you can pick one?
I like them both. Yeah. DMing is like really time consuming though, because even if you are kind of roll with whatever happens, it still takes a lot of effort to be ready for it and to set things up, and sort of you have to be familiar with the material and you have to know the rules. So it's a lot of work. So I like to, unfortunately, like the groups that I play with are pretty cool that we have rotating DMs. So, you know, I can DM for a few months and then take a break and play as a player for a few months and then somebody else takes over.
Oh,
so
nice.
That works out pretty well.
Nice. So one of the questions I always like to ask is, we can take inspiration from a number of people, a number of things, but is there anyone who sort of inspires you or your work that you want to give a little shout out to?
Yeah, I think a lot of the other people kind of doing work in this space are great. You mentioned Dr. Rachel Cohort, and she is certainly making success out of this, and seems to be figuring out how to popularize this sort of stuff and get it in front of people. So I think a lot of great notes can be taken from her work and her approach to doing it. Like some of the researchers that I've always sort of historically admired, this may sound like kind of a lame answer, but like Kahneman and Tversky, like that whole line, they were the ones that basically created and popularized the study of like judgment and decision making. So like when I was in grad school, we studied it under that name of judgment and decision making, and sort of eventually became known as behavioral economics. And the idea is like, let's study how people make decisions and make choices in real world, and how brains actually operate, as opposed to how like a utility maximizing formula says that they should operate. And those guys created like so many just really cool experiments, and it wasn't all just like making, you know, thought experiments and survey work and that sort of stuff. And, you know, that has its place, but like what they did was actually put like situations and decisions in front of people and then studied their results and really sort of intuitively manipulated the situations to uncover these hidden rules of decision-making, you know, that come out around things like loss aversion and framing and all these other sort of fundamental rules about human decision-making and thinking that I've written a lot about, you know, how they show up in game design and how they show up in player behavior.
Yeah.
And how designers and marketers sort of take advantage of that sort of stuff and will put you in situations where you're more likely to do what they want you to do for good or bad from the player's perspective.
I feel like I can hear like Celia Hoden being like, the dark triad.
That's right. So yeah, that kind of stuff I always found fascinating. And that was like the sort of stuff that I was reading a lot of when I decided to start psychologyofgames.com back all those years ago. And it was like, oh, well, I could write about these like biases and these foibles of mental decision making and how they show up in games. And that, like, the first several articles were like about that, and I continued to go back to that well for material to write about. So that's definitely another, you know, set of researchers that I admire.
Excellent stuff. I always just like to, it's always interesting to hear, so like within the context of like, you know, why people do what they do, but the people that they like to cite in that regard, it's so interesting to hear what people say. So let's say tomorrow you are going to call in Rich to work, and you decide, you know, before I start writing, I'm going to take a little break. You're going away to
a well-earned sabbatical. Yes.
Exactly right. Insert environment of your choice, you know. And you're going away, and you can take with you one film/TV show/series, if you can get it on one physical collection, that's fine. One album, one book, and one video game. What do you take?
Wow. Film's kind of hard to narrow down. I've never been able to think of, like, one, you know, film that I love. There's, like, periods of film like from that I get nostalgia about, from, you know, all the John Hughes from the 80s, and we've had like family movie nights where my wife or I pick like a film from the 80s or 90s that we loved and make our kids watch it. And, you know, like they love the Goonies, for example, but and they love the Matrix, but there's some other ones that, you know, didn't hit as much for them. So I'm not sure I have a real good answer for film. For album, maybe like Pearl Jam's 10 is, I think, you know, like one of the best albums ever made. Guns N' Roses' Appetite for Destruction might be up there as well. Nice. Greatest album of the 80s, and that whole era. So maybe one of those. A book. Could I include like a book series?
Yeah, if you can physically get it in a collection. I'm going to say that's all right.
Okay. Box set. Yeah. Maybe like Stephen King Dark Tower series.
Nice.
like, I don't think it's the greatest work of literature ever made. You know, Stephen King is very good at some stuff and not at others, but I always just really loved that series, especially like the first three books, which he wrote when he was much younger than when he went back to finish the series later in his career. I thought they were just like such a cool mashup of different genres and different thoughts. And in some ways, like you could see like where just some like young, you know, 19, 20 year old Stephen King was just like, yeah, this stuff is rad. This stuff is cool. I'm just going to like cram all of it in here. And this is so avant-garde. And it's like, okay, Steve, you know, calm down. But at the same time, it's like him doing his best work where it's just like super imaginative. And some of the character work is so good and so fun. And it's a good long series. So that would eat up a lot of my free time on my desert island sabbatical. Mm-hmm. A video game, probably like Elden Ring, I guess, would be maybe the unsatisfying answer. You know, I could go back. That's a big game. Mm-hmm. I could hopefully finish it. The real answer would be like some MMO, right? That would never
end. Yeah,
you'd never finish it. You're end it, or some multiplayer game, competitive multiplayer game or cooperative, something like Minecraft maybe would be a good choice as well. You build forever. I have a lot of fun with that, and this has online stuff in it. Mm-hmm. But Elden Ring, in the moment, would probably be my choice.
Excellent choice. Instead of a film, you could maybe have TV box set, if that would make it a bit easier.
Let's take all of, say, 30 Rock.
Nice.
The TV show. Or no, wait, Parks and Rec. Parks and Recreation. Classic. I've been meaning to do a rewatch of that. Anyway,
Parks and Rec is fantastic.
It's good comfort TV. Yeah,
excellent. They are. It sounds like a fun sabbatical. I'll say that.
Yeah.
As we sort of begin to wind down, the last sort of couple of questions are: firstly, have you enjoyed being a guest on a podcast as opposed to the host?
Yeah. No, I always love coming on to talk shop. And like I said, I let my guests do most of the talking on my podcast. So it's always fun to get asked the same types of questions and to be able to talk shop about psychology and games. So I always have fun.
Excellent. Second is, where can people find you? What's the best place for people to reach you? All the links will be attached wherever you found this.
Yeah. Psychologygames.com is if you went to one URL to find out about me, that's the place to go, because it's got all of the podcasts, all of the articles that I've written over the year. There's literally hundreds of them that are just sitting there free, waiting for you to come discover them. And then also there's links there to find out how to follow me on social media, mostly Twitter. I'm at Jamie Madigan on Twitter. I have like a Facebook group that I update whenever I put new stuff out as well. And then psychologygames.com/book. Is it book or books?
If you've played the Wordle, you'll know that S makes a big difference.
That's true. Yeah. It's slash book. You can find out about the engagement game and the Getting Gamers, the Psychology of Video Games books there, and any future ones that I may put out, as well as some other works that I've like written chapters for as well. You can find that stuff there.
Excellent. Well, I always like to turn the tables and say, do you have any questions for me? I've had a couple. I've had the Desert Island one, I think, a couple of times. But anything, any burning questions that have developed through the course of the episode?
What are your career plans and expectations? Like, where do you want to go with this whole psychology and video games and other related stuff?
The dreaded, where do you see yourself in 5 years?
Yeah.
Honestly,
next 5 days sometimes. Five days. I wonder.
Within sort of the next couple of weeks, PAX East, hopefully.
Nice. Yeah, I couldn't make it this year. I had great times at PAX East, so please enjoy some PAX for me.
I will take an extra bite. honestly, not in academia.
No?
Honestly, like, there's a lot I want to do in research, but I just, the bureaucracy, the systems just don't sit well with me. It's just, it's energy I haven't got. Like, marking is the worst thing in existence. I like teaching. I'll do, like, guest lecturing for anyone, because that's no marking. But that, I just don't enjoy it so much, I think. I'd love to, you know, work sort of in some sort of sector-related stuff and sort of maybe, like, work with, like, game design, you know. Doing my area specifically is video games and student mental health. So, you know, looking, like, along those lines. So really looking at, like, what are these practical applications to help reduce stigmatization and potentially, you know, like, help change people's sort of thinking a little bit. You know, I mean, I'm very privileged to say I'm already affiliated with charities like Safe in Our World, Take This. You know, like, doing research with those type of organizations, I think, is the dream job, really, at this point. If I'm being really ambitious, I had a dream a while ago to get into some level of therapeutic practice. Now, it's very, the route is a little bit different in the UK in that you essentially have to have a PhD as a doctorate because PsyDs don't really exist. You can do professional doctorates and maybe a clinical doctorate, but they're like, the pool of those is very small. That most people do a PhD in research and then do like a year's training to work clinically. There's also therapeutically, psychotherapeutically is the exact term. I'd love to do that, like work with people one-to-one. And, you know, maybe include games as part of that. I know that's a thing that people do. So, yeah, I've got a lot of research. I've got a lot of things that I want to shout about, particularly in the mental health space and in the disability space. So, yeah, like, I don't know, like a little bit of everything, like some research here, some activist work here, I guess, like...
Yeah,
maybe play some games. That'd be great.
It's called research. Yeah, when you're doing that.
Not enough research on my end. Then need to do more research.
Hire some assistants. Play some games for you.
Yeah, can you write? Can you just play this and write a review? Thanks, that'd be great.
Yeah. Write this grant proposal.
Yeah. Well, that's all the questions from me. If there's anything else you want to say, otherwise, Jamie.
No, this has been great. Thanks for having me on. It's always a good discussion.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for coming on. As I say again, thanks for doing the podcast. Thanks for having the website. It's great. I wouldn't have a citation list without it.
Glad to help.
So for I'm just going to flick over to the ending screen for those watching the video. We'll now say goodbye. Thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. Jamie, I am pleased to say I have been psyched to be with you. Thank you for joining the show.
Same.
And we'll see you all next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, thank you so much for listening to another episode of Psyched to Be With You. I hope you enjoyed it just as much as I did. If you did, do please leave a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. It really helps. Otherwise, check out the description of the episode for the links for the guest, but also to keep up with information about the show and myself. I really hope you enjoyed this listen. Until next time, take it easy, look after your mind, body and soul, and I'll see you again for another episode very, very soon. Bye bye.